The opening words this morning come from James Baldwin, who is a great writer, thinker, shaker, and mover. And he wrote, "It is rare indeed that people give. Most people guard and keep. They suppose that it is they themselves and what they identify with themselves that they are guarding and keeping. Whereas what they are actually guarding and keeping is their system of reality and what they assume themselves to be. One can give nothing whatever without giving oneself, that is to say, risking oneself. If one cannot risk oneself, then one is simply incapable of giving. We all give in many ways, but the best way is to give from the self." Let us take a moment to greet each other and welcome each other and help everyone feel at home here. I welcome dun 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 dun. As surely as we belong to the universe, we belong together. We join here to transcend the isolated self, to reconnect, to know ourselves, to be at home here on earth, under the stars, linked with each other, giving and sharing, so that we may create the beloved community here and outside these walls.
This quote is from Pema Chodron. "We don't set out to save the world. We set out to wonder how other people are doing and to reflect on how our actions affect other people's hearts." We light the chalice with that in mind.
So I draw your attention to the announcements in our order of service. They are much of what organizes our life here, but of course there are many other things. And now let us stand as you are able and sing our opening hymn, "The Morning Hangs a Signal," number 40.
Wow.
Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows and acknowledge the mutual support of our community and our friends. If you would like to please share a brief and personal expression of joy or sorrow, this is the time to do so.
I am afraid of... Wait, I can hurt it. I am afraid of...
That was I am a paleontologist, for those of you who don't speak three-year-old. And that is his joy, is definitely dinosaurs. My joy that I wanted to share is that we had a successful trip to Boston last week, and Katie and I both got a diagnosis and a treatment plan started, and she is expected to outgrow a lot of her problems over the next 5 years. So that was really good news for us.
Great.
Jim Chanteau, on this day in 1950, my youngest brother Bill was born. He sadly died in 1994 of colon cancer, which is a reminder to all of you that although it may seem distasteful, it is certainly appropriate to have colon cancer checks. It kills far too many people.
Bryce Hobrock. I've been wondering for some time about the fate of Sylvia Blanding, who left the Manhattan community several years ago, and many of us knew her. I learned last night that she had died in November of 2012.
Thanks for sharing that, Bryce.
Michael Oldfather, yesterday afternoon, Kathleen and I represented the congregation at the dedication of Shawnee Mission, UU's new building in Lenexa. They had been Overland Park, then Shawnee Mission, or then Shawnee Mission, then Overland Park, and now Lenexa, but the name stays the same. Like us, they bought an old school. Unlike us, they bought a huge school. You would not believe how big this place is. It's the biggest elementary school I was ever inside. And much of it has been redone, and it's a beautiful place, and it was a great experience to be there singing in the choir with other UUs from around the neighborhood. But about a third of it is just sitting there waiting for some kind of opportunity. The classrooms, their classrooms are somewhat bigger than our big classroom. It is just impressive. I mean, somebody says, we'd like to do something. We need some space. All right. You got it. What a way to live.
Larry Weaver, my adult son, the Jay, who some of you know has struggled with alcoholism and depression, but successfully for the last 7 or 8 years, was visiting this week, and we needed to have some hard conversations, but I'm happy, and it's a joy that we in fact had them, and so I'm delighted that he was here with me this week.
Taylor Bachman, have a joy, Rita, and a sorrow. Rita and the boys leave for India for 4 weeks on Tuesday. And the sorrow is I don't get to go with them, and I'll miss them for 4 weeks starting Tuesday. Mm.
May we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, and those we hold in silence in our hearts.
Today's discussion is on community and how building community helps make good choices that support everyone as a whole and yourself individually. Does anybody know what a community is? Yes, part.
Share food.
Yes, part of community is sharing food. Is anybody else? Yes?
Like, maybe a group of people that help each other?
That's right, groups of people that help each other. That's right. Community is also getting out and getting to know your neighbors, like everyone did here this morning by coming to the fellowship. That's right. And it's also playing together, like you guys are all going to do in Sunday school after we're done with the morning discussion. It's also coming together as a group to help others and to help the environment. Yes, you help lots of people. Well, please. When Rita Carter Tucker and I moved here, we came from a co-housing community, which had a very great sense of community. Some examples of that was the shared garden. Does anybody know what a shared garden is? Let someone else. Yes. That's right. Anybody else? Yes, Carter.
Once Eric died, he went to the animal shelter.
Yes, sorry, that was sad of Emma. But a shared garden is also a large plot that you break down into little tiny spots for each individual person, and there's also areas that are for the whole community where you grow stuff that grows in abundance, like squash, where anyone can go pick a squash and have it for dinner. But when you have your own individual garden, sometimes you grow like green beans and you have lots and lots of green beans. And there's no way you could possibly eat all those green beans without them going bad. So part of being a community is sharing some of those green beans with your neighbors who might like green beans also. Another example of a community is doing a community work day. That's where you go around and you clean up the neighborhood, you pull weeds, you pick up the trash, you might put mulch around the flower beds and the trees. By doing that, it helps clean up the neighborhood, and it makes the neighborhood look nice. It also makes you feel good about yourself because you helped out and made everything look nice and pretty. Another example that they did in the co-housing was the shared meals. Does anybody know what shared meals are? Yes, Tucker.
We eat meat and we
Yes, you shared your sandwich. That's right. Yes. Correct, that's right. In the co-housing community, there was shared meals twice a week. And this, you didn't have to cook, you didn't have to clean, you didn't pay for any of the meals. You just showed up and eat, and you enjoyed the company of all your friends and family. However, twice a quarter, you did have to cook, clean, and pay for the meal for everybody. It was a very nice situation where you got to know a lot of people in the neighborhood, and you got to enjoy good food and conversation. Who here was at the chili cook-off last night?
Hey, my mom won.
Your mom won, and Carter's mom came in second. Wow. Well, the chili cook-off was kind of an example of a shared meal because everybody got together and enjoyed each other's company and got to eat some really, really good food. So by building a community, you get to enjoy the company of your friends and family. Mm-hmm. Yep, you get to help others in the environment. And it makes you feel good because you're able to meet people and get out and enjoy the outside and help make the neighborhood look nice. It also provides good energy and gives you a sense of pride in your neighborhood and your community. All right? Okay, everyone. Well, go now in peace.
Go now in peace.
May the spirit of love surround you everywhere you may go.
Now is one of the favorite times in the month when we get to share with a wider community with our Helping Hand Sunday. So would Deb please come forward?
Good morning, everyone. I want to, first of all, thank you once again for inviting somebody from the Peggy Bowman Second Chance Fund to talk about what it is we do and why we do it. I have the honor right now of being the director of the Peggy Bowman Fund. Peggy Bowman herself, who has been the director for a number of years, decided to retire in July. And so I, amongst all the other volunteers on the board, offered to be the one to assume the responsibility of director. But let me tell you, that responsibility is an honor from the standpoint that we have women who serve on this board of an organization that provides much-needed money to low-income women who decide they either need emergency contraceptives or have decided they want to end a pregnancy. We have a dedicated group of women from all over the state, women from Wichita, Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, here in Manhattan, who are working very hard to ensure that a woman's right to choose to make that decision remains intact. For those of you that don't know, this fund was started in 1996, so we've been around for almost 20 years. And during that time, we have consistently watched government action erode women's options for health care. So the need for this fund is more important than ever. This last year in 2012, the fund served 249 women, and we did that with a little over $75,000. And all that money came from individuals such as yourselves or organizations who believe it's important for a woman to have the right to choose. All of the money that is donated goes directly to support those women. We don't use any of the money that's donated to pay anybody's salaries. We don't pay rent. We all volunteer our time for this. It's kind of, for me, difficult to explain to you how important this fund is without actually sharing with you some of what we hear from the women who are served. Women are not required to, but oftentimes they send us thank you notes to let us know how much they appreciate the support we provide. And I need to make it clear, our fund is the fund that, after all other avenues of support have been contacted, we make up that last amount that they need. So on average, we're usually providing about $300 per woman to pay for the procedure. But to give you an idea of what some of the women say, and again, some of these notes are anonymous. Sometimes they sign their names. Sometimes they simply just write thank you and nothing more. But this will give you an idea of how important this fund is to these women. I would like to tell you how much this means to me. Without your funding, I don't know what I would do. This means more than I could even begin to explain. Hopefully one day, eventually, I will be able to pay it forward. Thank you again. I just want the Peggy Bowman Fund to know how thankful I am to have your services. Words can't even explain how happy I am to you guys helping me. I could not believe how much of a burden you took off my shoulders. I was up all times of the night, not being able to sleep, just thinking about how miserable I and a child would be if I had to be under this monster man's care. It is such a relief what you have done for me, and I truly appreciate it. Being the person that used to look at people sideways for getting these types of procedures, I now look at things totally different. Neither me nor my family believed in these types of things, but everybody have to do what they have to do. We're different and have different reasons, and I wouldn't have been able to do what I needed to do without your help. Thank you, thank you, thank you very much. Another one that says, thank you for helping our daughter. Your help is appreciated by our daughter, by us, her parents, and by her grandparents. She will be able to finish college, start her life, and then have a family with a man she truly loves. Again, thank you so much. And then just one more. My husband and I were joyfully pregnant with our second child. We had our 21-week ultrasound, and they discovered our baby had half a brain and half a heart, which meant zero chance of survival. To make our day even worse, we discovered that our insurance company would not pay to terminate the pregnancy. With all our medical bills piling up, we were unsure we could afford the costly termination. Therefore, we are very grateful your organization is around. I'm truly grateful to you guys. I'm appalled that insurance does not cover things like this. I'm not sure who I should contact to make sure women can always have the option to abort, but if you could provide me with their information, I will gladly voice my opinion. Again, thank you so much. Without your help, I can now move on from that horrible day. So all the circumstances vary, but you know, the one thing that these women all have in common, they're either pregnant or had unprotected sex recently. They know that the situation is not healthful, not healthy for them or their families, and they don't have all the necessary money to pay for this. We are proud to be able to say that since the fund started, we have never, never turned away a woman who needed help. We have been able to provide something to every woman who has asked, and we would like to be able to continue to do that. You are one of the congregations that has supported us for a long time. Many of your members support us, and for that we're truly grateful and appreciate that all that you can do to help us. So thank you.
So this is the story of how I decided what I want to be when I grow up, so far. One of the things that Amber researches in relationship research is a concept that her field calls sliding versus deciding. The main idea is that it's pretty common in relationships to get more serious without a clear conscious decision by the people involved to make it that way. So somebody's lease is running out and we're together anyway and we can save some money and it just kind of makes sense. Why don't we move in together? Or, well, we've been together a long time and it seems like when people have been together this long, they get married, so I guess that's what we ought to do. Sliding can be sticking with the status quo, or it can be following a script without really putting a lot of thought into it. And research has found that people in relationships that slide more have more ambiguity, more uncertainty, and they're less satisfied. Deciding is the pretty clear opposite of that, and it's actively choosing when you want to increase commitment to a relationship, and that increases the ability to make decisions that involves some sacrifice, but it leads ultimately to much higher satisfaction. This concept has been really powerful for me in all aspects of my life, including romantic relationships, but not just limited to that. And so it's when I started figuring out what I wanted to be, I started by majoring in chemical engineering in college. I was good at math, I was good at chemistry, I liked them both okay. It was a degree that leads to a job, so okay. A job kind of fell into my lap at a really big oil company, which was great. It was prestigious, had a good salary. From all appearances, I was very successful and everything was great, but I wasn't happy. It was a job that fit with values that were set by other people, especially fit with my parents' values. But it didn't fit with mine. I realized I wasn't making the difference that I wanted to be. So when Amber decided to get her PhD, we had to move, and I had a chance to take what I'd learned about myself from working at ExxonMobil and to do something with it. So I figured out that I put some thought into what I valued, what I wanted to do, what I wanted to accomplish. I got a book called What Color Is Your Parachute, which is kind of outlines a methodology for figuring out all of those things and coming to a decision about what you want to try and do. And when I was doing this, nothing really fell into my lap, but I actively pursued a lot of things. I was lucky, but it was much more intentional than my first job. I had several options that were, some of them were more similar to what I had been doing, but I made a hard decision, and I took a job that I had to drive an hour each way to do because I had figured out that I like working with people, and that was the one that let me do that. At some point, I heard about a field called systems consulting, and the basic idea is that you take the principles from family therapy, how to get people to have better relationships, and you apply them in the business world, and you help family-owned businesses work together as a family to be successful and fulfilled, or a group of management that's infighting to stop so that they can actually lead their company and help their company be successful, or have better relationships between management and workers. I think a lot of people have seen dysfunctional relationships in the business world, and it's pretty clear there's a lot of use for this field. But it's not one that people have really heard of, and it's not real common to get into, so it was a little bit hard. But I figured out that that's what I like, that's what I find fulfilling, and so I decided to get a degree in social work to learn to work, get more training and credentials both, to work with people and to work with large organizations and to help them move forward. So because of all of that, once we moved here, I had a clean slate again. I decided to start a company to do that. I was also able to decide based on talking with Amber and with what we value, I was able to decide to stay home most of the time to be a dad to our new son. Deciding to do these things wasn't very easy, but without making clear conscious decisions, I couldn't have this job because the field basically almost doesn't exist yet. Making the choice to stay at home goes against a lot of social conventions. It goes against a lot of pressure. It's getting better, but there's still some there, especially when I could have still been the primary breadwinner for our family. But it was a better fit for me. And now I help organizations and individuals figure out what their strengths are, what they want to do, and what they want to be. Because without that vision, you're much more likely to follow an easier, familiar path rather than the more difficult path that leads to greater growth and satisfaction.
Michael Mead, a great mythologist and someone who works with kids at risk because he was a kid at risk in New York in the 40s and 50s, a part of the gang life, Irish gangs beating up on each other, killing each other. But he's turned mythology into a way to really help people. So this comes from him. Despite the ancient instinct to become one who gives as well as receives from life, most people identify as consumers. The trouble with consuming is that in the end, people can't really get enough of what they don't really need or want. It becomes an addiction that feeds itself. The trouble with a consumer society is that it eventually consumes itself. Lacking importance of purpose and destiny, humans are reduced to becoming vagrant consumers in a world in which they have nothing essential to give or to learn. Within the blank slate approach to life, the roots of blind materialism and blatant consumerism are found. In this world of blatant consumerism, nihilism takes root, takes hold, and flourishes. Violence becomes a way of life that we see in every sector of our media. Violence becomes somehow an easy way out. While creating safe places where meaningless violence does not destroy ourselves, our children, and those we love is very important and good. But when we do nothing to help replace meaningless violence with meaning, when we choose to shield ourselves with pessimism, live inside its great, vast denial, we inadvertently contribute to the escalation of violence in our culture and its root cause, alienation. Disconnection from the beloved community. We need vision. We need it as individuals. We need it as families. We need it as communities. We need it as being connected to the larger community. We need something that helps us decide what is important to give ourselves to. Unitarian Universalism challenges us at its very roots, its entire history, its heritage, to not take the easy way out. It challenges us to be meaning makers, co-creators with the cosmos. Today, in this hour, in this moment, right here, in the days to come, the weeks and the months and years. This community and its sanctuary, here we are asked by our heritage to create a better world for all, to bring our boldest dreams of what can be. This is a place for big dreaming. Big dreaming. We need a vision that fosters the courage necessary to do this essential work, We need a vision that fosters a way of being with one another that doesn't count paper clips, but looks at what needs to happen to make it a place where we can all share the goodness of being alive in this, our beautiful earth. When you have shared a vision, when you share a vision, things like, oh, I want it my way, oh, your way is the wrong way, becomes subservient to a larger goal. Being the person who is right, being the person who gets to decide, becomes subservient to a mission of doing good in the world. Because it's always what's calling you. And if that small-minded way of being discredits the ability to work with others and align with a vision that sees your purpose as helping to create the beloved community, then you're failing the vision. So forgiveness becomes an essential component in every aspect of creating this bold and great dream. Forgiveness of ourselves when we fail to do the better thing, when we fall prey to petty behavior. Forgiveness of others when they do the same. And finding a way to work with one another so that we can help. When we have a shared vision, it brings us into a magnanimous place where the dream of what can be, what we can do as a community, is larger than any one person. And it is not about having the best idea. It is about putting love into action. And it's just not something on our wish list, a good feeling. It is something we do. This last week, I had the pleasure of meeting Amy Hilgendorf on Wednesday afternoon, and I learned that she was leaving for Madison to remake their lives as a husband and a wife and their daughter that will be born in 6 weeks. And she said to me that they were leaving on Friday morning. Her parents and parents-in-law were coming up with a truck to help them move. And I said, oh, so you'll be really busy on Friday. She goes, the thing that I'm doing on Friday is I am going to the Happy Kitchen, and I am going to work there. So the very last thing that she did before leaving Manhattan was to go help feed the hungry. And one of the kind of little conversations that sometimes would trickle up to being important that Amy and her husband had was, why aren't you coming with me to the fellowship? I don't feel like it. He has said in the last couple of months, as their child Petra is waiting to be born, that when they move to Madison, he's going to start going to a fellowship. So the work that we do here can really have great impact in lives later on. They want their daughter, Petra, to grow up believing in the goodness of being a human being and doing good works. And they believe that having a foundation that is faith-based, faith in the goodness of human beings, is very important. We each need to be aware of what gifts we have to share and find the strength and courage to share them, so that these gifts may be joined together and the gift becomes larger. Drew was talking about this sliding and deciding. And so sometimes I wonder if we take that lens of looking at the relationship that we have here with each other in this fellowship, where are we at on that scale of sliding or deciding? It's probably something that's always in motion and in flux. But my hope is that we become better at deciding and do less sliding. Oh, this is the way we do things here, so we can't even think about change. Change is often uncomfortable, but it asks the very most important thing of us, to risk being ourselves. to risk becoming someone we don't know we are, as individuals and as a community. And so in the context of my personal life, I was thinking about how do you make decisions that impact how you use your resources? I mean, your time, your talent, and your treasure. And about 12 years ago, as we were both setting very nicely into middle age with the back beginning to ache and the hip hurting sometimes and that shoulder blade from that accident from 30 years ago acting up, a hot tub with 21 jets was on our list. And we thought, wow, oh, okay, first we got to pay to have a cement pad put in. Oh, that's not that much. And then we'll go out and buy the hot tub. So we were on the road to getting the hot tub, which we did buy, by the way. I thought, we have almost everything we could possibly want or need. And here we are going out and spending a rather large amount of money so that we can sit and enjoy the stars and the snow and the rain, which is a beautiful and good thing. But I said to Chuck, I said, we don't really think about how we spend our money, do we? And there was silence. And then, as often the case, when things become uncomfortable, Chuck began to yawn. And I said, why don't we really commit to trying to figure out how we use our money and begin to really see where charity and charitable causes and things we believe in have a place in how we look at money and use money. So from that point on, we have become increasingly conscious, and we're not yet where we want to be. And my gold standard for that is a very good friend of ours, Charlotte Shivers, who I went to seminary with. She's about 76, and her husband, Bob, is about 83. Bob was a school teacher for 40 years. Charlotte sold real estate before she became a minister. And as you know, ministers don't make big bucks. At least most ministers do not. I asked Charlotte last year, I said, so how much do you guys give to your church? And how much do you give each year? And what process do you use to decide? Now, remember, they drive, or you don't know this, they drive a 1992 Corolla, right? They live in an old farmhouse that they rent half of it out to someone else. They give $15,000 a year to charity, more than half of that to their church. But they also go to Japan to visit their son. They spend 2 months in Florida every year enjoying the warmth as their old bones hate the cold Iowa winters now. So it's not that they are so abstemious that they don't enjoy the riches that, you know, material wealth can bring. But they have found a way to balance how they give so that they receive maximum joy for the dollars that they have to share. And I think that's an incredible challenge for me to think about. And everyone has to have their own way of calibrating what's important to them. And I think guilt is the absolute worst way to create a culture of generosity. So this was really a critical moment in our lives when we said, what are we doing with our money and why? We do not have children. We have nieces and nephews who are having children. So of course we're going to give some money to them, but it became apparent to us that just giving money to your family didn't seem to do a lot of good in the world. It was helpful to them. But really, what did it do if they were going to go out and buy a boat, a jet ski, you know, or a new house or a Lexus or something? I don't know what they're going to do with it. I hope that's not how they use this money, but they might. That's their choice. But we have thought, well, let's figure out other ways that we can use our resources when we die so that they can really contribute to doing good in the world. And so a couple years ago, we left a large bequest to Star King's School for Ministry, where I went to seminary. And it feels so good to know that we are helping to educate people like Eric Banner to become ministers who will go out and share the progressive message and do the good work necessary. That fills my heart with goodness. Unitarian Universalism is a faith that saves people's lives at its best. And this fellowship is a community of people who do the work of saving lives. But I imagine that we could do so much more. We ask and wonder and face questions that may go unanswered and seek answers that may challenge our assumptions. In William Ellery Channing's words, the father of American Unitarianism said that Unitarians will not content itself with a passive hereditary faith, but opens itself to light whensoever it may come. It does not mechanically copy the past, but listens for new and higher monitions of conscience. It is not passive about its inheritance. It says that we need to be relevant today and tomorrow and for our grandchildren and their grandchildren. So it's not just about today or yesterday. To stay alive and vital, we must continue to explore what it means to be relevant. Why? So that Xavier, Drew, and Amber's newborn son will have a place that welcomes him at every stage of his life and where he will find the support and encouragement necessary to live out of his most deep and powerful self so that he may love the world with an open heart and mind. If you do not think this is important, I would ask you to ask our families with children in our RE program how important it is to them. To counter the prevailing messages of you are going to hell that our children hear in school on the playground, and to be strong enough not to wilt in the face of that condemnation. This is a powerful lesson, and we need to support that. And it's also so that he may have a place which holds him dear, where he is loved for everything he is, even when he may be screaming at the top of his lungs or running down the hallway with the mother and father saying, "No, no, you can't run." How will he learn to be a force of good in the world? It's by our example, his parents' example, and the ways he finds his place in the world. How do we create a legacy that affirms his potential to lead with love, that nurtures his sense of justice? Victoria Stafford, a colleague of mine, tells a story about a woman on a subway train in New York City. The station is very crowded, and if anybody's been in New York City, you know just how crowded that can be. You can barely breathe. And she leaves the train that she's been on, and she realizes that she's only holding one glove. And as she looks back from the car that she just left, she sees her glove lying on the chair. She does not have enough time to run back into the car to get that glove. So what does she do? She throws the other glove in her hand into the seat so that there is a pair of gloves for someone who may need them. So So how does someone get to this place of making a snap decision about sharing? It comes from a life of giving. A life of saying, ah, I don't need that, here you go, take it. It's not just a kind of happenstance, oh, this just happened once. It comes from creating a capacity to be generous and to have gratitude for all the things that we are given in life. A critical... Oh, I've already been there, sorry. What she did may look like a frivolous gesture, gratuitous, spontaneous, a spur-of-the-moment thing, but you know she must have lived a lifelong life of generosity, a life of wild and creative generosity of spirit, to be able to think so quickly, to act so urgently and healthfully, and to know precisely in that moment what would bless the world right then and there. It happened in an instant, but that was planned giving, through and through. Something in her past, or everything in her past, prepared that woman for her gesture. Habits of living and giving, practiced and refined for a whole life long. All our past is a prologue and prepares us for these opportunities. How do you make a legacy? Some people devote themselves to science, education, good works. Others to music, the arts. Others risk their lives and selves, their souls and congregations, struggling against the odds to be who they are and who they are called to be. Some people toss their glove deliberately and gladly and regularly with no regrets. All this is planned giving. It does not occur by accident, however spontaneous it looks. How will you spend or use up your life? An important question. Are you sliding or are you deciding? Last year, this congregation sustained a hard succession of losses. The deaths of several beloved members in a row. We lost Doris Grosch, who had been a very healthy and contributing member for years to this fellowship. And then we lost June and Phil Kermser within a couple months. June is a part of the organization of this fellowship back in the 50s. She was secretary for many, many years and then kind of dropped to the wayside as other activities consumed her. And as anybody who knows June, she was highly committed to education and really, really being an advocate for everyone, no matter how old you are, no matter how young you are, no matter what race you are, to get a good education. June gave of herself continuously in that regard. I had been visiting with her for 6 years, and she lived in a 50s house that needed a good paint job. The inside needed a paint job. The chairs were comfortable, but, you know, they were, like, dated. There was nothing fancy in the kitchen, and there was the old piano that Phil had brought with him from Minnesota that he still played until he had his stroke about a year before he died. These were things that they had been living with for a long, long time, and they didn't think they needed or wanted anything new. Maybe a paint job would have been a good idea. But lo and behold, I had no idea that June and Phil would leave in their bequest a very good legacy to this congregation. They have left us over $150,000. Who would have guessed that that was going to happen? I didn't. But I do know from talking with June many, many times, and especially in those months as she was dying, how important it was for her to pay attention to the big details, the big picture. She wrote as one of her last editorials, even though writing was excruciatingly painful, to Governor Brownback about the state of the arts. It was a great editorial that was in the Manhattan Mercury. To the very end, she was standing up for the people who were dispossessed. And she would want us to use that money to dream big. To dream in such a way that all children have a good opportunity to come into this world healthy and safe and get a good education and do good things in the world. So she has left us a legacy that is more than a dollar amount. She asks each of us, and Phil does too, to not slide, but to decide. To take this mission of being a beloved community to heart and out into the world. So as we approach our stewardship campaign, please do not slide. Be willing to talk to people and share what you love about this fellowship, what you would like to see happen in this fellowship. Let it be a vital and passionate discussion about what you believe and what you think. Do not slide. Commit yourselves to a better world. So, we have a few minutes for discussion. I would like to hear other people's ideas about ways we could decide instead of slide. I like that. The decision to be moving into the future with robustness and big dreams.
I just wanted to say that I know for a lot of families, religion is a very sliding thing. You go to whatever church your family went to, and that's just kind of the way it is. But I grew up an atheist in Abilene, Kansas. There are not a lot of atheists in Abilene, Kansas, and there's no UU church there. So we were the kids on the playground being told we were going to hell. I have distinct memories of being told I was going to hell, or my friends trying to convert me and taking me to Bible camp. And I think the worst of all was people telling me that my father would go to hell as he lay on his deathbed from cancer, and sending Bibles to our house and things like that. So it was a big decision for us to actually come here. My husband was raised Christian, but has since kind of lost that faith. And so for us to go to any type of a church felt really weird, because all I had ever heard from the church was that I was going to hell, which I always thought was kind of a strange thing to tell someone, you're going to hell that you don't believe in. It seemed like kind of a strange threat, since I didn't believe in hell. But nonetheless, for us coming to the fellowship often even still feels a little odd, because I didn't grow up with that church community, that second home. But we made the decision while I was pregnant that we really wanted that for our children. We wanted them to have a community of like-minded people and to know that they weren't the only child on the playground who didn't believe in God. They weren't the only child on the playground who didn't go to Bible study. And so for us, it was a big decision to come here, and we're still kind of getting used to it. We still have to call it the fellowship, because going to church just still sounds too weird for me.
Thank you.
I just have a short thing, Anna Franklin. I remember years and years ago, when I was still very much sliding, being in the car waiting for someone, and in the car with me was my friend's 7-year-old, I think, daughter. And she just said to me, making conversation, do you believe in God? And I said, yes. And she said, I don't. And I really almost jumped when I heard her say that out of the mouths of, you know, very young children. That kind of decision, she was right there. She was deciding.
And I was sliding.
I'm Sabrina Boker. I've been a Buddhist for a long time, but I've been kind of sliding on that too. So I'm going to have to be deciding to go back to meditation and chanting and stuff. I've been devoted to the temple for a long time, but there's more to Buddhism than just going to the temple and helping out the monk and all that. So I've been sliding, but I think I'm going to go back to deciding. Thank you.
Jim Chanteau. Shortly after Doreen died, I had to decide what to do sort of with assets. I didn't need them. I had enough, and she left a fair amount, not knowing how long she would live. And so I decided to set up a Doreen Chanteau scholarship fund in the psychology department at K-State with most of that money. And I thought that would be kind of the end of it, but, you know, it was nice that it was there. What often happens when you make a decision like that, and I haven't heard this point made, is it affects other people in ways you never would have expected. What I have found is that, you know, anyone can give to it's actually not called a scholarship fund, it's a fellowship, but anybody can give to it. And over the years since it's been set up, a number of the psychology department alumni, including some that actually were early recipients, have given money to that fund. And it now has much more money than I put in it. So when you start something, sometimes there's these wonderful repercussions in the future that you never anticipated. I never thought anybody else would give to it, and now it's happening.
Katie?
Thank this brave lady behind me. I'm sorry, Jessica? I'm Katie. It's good to hear stories about other kids who grew up atheist. My family, my parents, they kind of wanted to confuse us, I think, so they sent us to Catholic school where we learned the catechism, and then by night they'd indoctrinate us in atheism. So I think our critical thinking skills were honed at an early age because we were really comfortable with ambiguity and dissonance by age 8 or so. But what I wanted to say was, to comment, since joining the fellowship, I've wished so many times that we had been a part of a community like this, that would have accepted my parents' varying views, that would have accepted us and our strangeness. And I'm so grateful to have that for my kids. And one thing I want to speak about, I don't know if this is the dream big that you're asking, I don't think it is the dream big that you're talking about, Michael, but something that's been so significant to the daughter, my eldest daughter, is the OWLS program that UU continues to offer. And I hope as we move forward that offering those kind of whole life thinking and education programs for children will really be a part of that. That was a hugely significant thing for my daughter Iris, and I know it is for other kids who participate.
Do you hear that, Sue? All right, we have time for Sue.
Good morning, I'm Sue Prey, and was it Larry Weaver that did the story about the stone soup? Anyway, it was good, and if you remember, I think that kind of a community spirit would be good going forward for us. It's like, you know, maybe you just have a carrot to give, but with the potatoes and the whatever, it makes a soup, and so maybe you can't give $150,000 or you don't have an idea about how to save the world, but maybe you have an idea how to do an event or something good for the group, and maybe you have $10. So anyway, stone soup, go. Everybody can participate.
Right. All right, Harriet, and that's it then, okay?
I don't think anybody has thanked the social committee for that great event last night, and that's a great builder of community.
Yes.
So thank you.
Solo? let us now stand and sing our closing hymn. I think it's 140. I lost my program. 118. 318. Thank you very much. That's community at work. Please be seated. Just a quick announcement. After the service at 12:15, the Deepening Your Understanding of Unitarian Universalism first session will begin at 12:15 in here. Now let me share these closing words. Spirit of life that embraces people who believe in God and people who do not, and the entire range between. Teach us to break down barriers, to widen horizons, to make us less judgmental. Help us to see the larger picture and the kinder conclusion, to love and to let live, to embrace and forgive, to sustain and care. Help us to reach out to our better selves that we may love more and hate less, care more and reject less, to give from our good hearts so that we are bound together by an understanding that may sustain us each through trial and tribulation, through joy and happiness, through sickness and health, so that our loving force and the world may do more good. May we be joined in this common purpose of hope and fulfillment. May it renew and revive us. We seek a common holy ground for one and all. Go in peace.